Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, I ended with the question of governmental inefficiency regarding business. It's a common objection to getting the government involved in business because the claim is that it is notoriously inefficient at those pursuits. But Betty Reed Mandel, author of Selling Uncle Sam, maintains that this reputation is undeserved. She points out that the only enterprises left to government are those from which private enterprise cannot make a profit. Surveys show that in-house operation of publicly provided services is generally more efficient than contracting them out, while privatizing public infrastructure for private profit has typically led to increased costs, inefficiency, and corruption. A case in point is the deregulation and privatization of electricity in California, which met with heavy criticism as an economic disaster for the state. Complex publicly provided services tend to break down with privatization just from the complexity of contracting and supervising the contract. Privatization of the British rail system caused rate increases, rail accidents, and system breakdown to the point that a majority of the British public now favors returning to government ownership and operation. Catherine Austin Fitz concurs, drawing her experience as Assistant Secretary of HUD. She writes, quote, "The public policy solution has been to outsource government functions to make them more productive. In fact, this jump in overhead is simply a subsidy provided to private companies and organizations that receive thereby a guaranteed return regardless of performance. We have subsidies and financing to support housing programs that make no economic sense except for the property managers and owners who build and manage it for layers of fees. Close quote. Government services may appear to be inefficient because public funding is lacking to do the job properly. But this inefficiency is not an inherent characteristic of government workers. Clerks working for the government have to compete and perform to hold on to their jobs, just as clerks working in private industry do. To the clerk, there is not much difference whether she is working for the government or for a big multinational corporation. It is not her business. Either way, she is just getting paid to take orders and carry them out. Beating out the competition by cutthroat practices is not the only way to motivate workers. Pride of performance, a desire for promotion, and higher salaries, and a belief in the team project are also effective prods. Recall the Indian study we discussed comparing service and customer satisfaction from private sector and public sector banks, in which the government-owned Bank of India came out on top in all areas surveyed. Banks that are government agencies would have a number of practical advantages that could actually make them more efficient in the marketplace than their private counterparts. A government banking agency could advance loans without keeping reserves. Like in the Tally system or the Let's system, it would just be advancing credit. A truly national bank would not need to worry about going bankrupt, and it would not need an FDIC to insure its deposits. It could issue loans impartially to anyone who satisfied its requirements in the same way that the government issues driver's licenses to anyone who qualifies now. Interest-free lending might not materialize anytime soon, but loans could be issued at an interest rate that was modest and fixed, returning reliability and predictability to borrowing. The Federal Reserve would no longer have to tamper with interest rates to control the money supply indirectly, because it would have direct control of the national currency at its source. A system of truly national banks would return to the people their most valuable asset, the right to create their own money. Like the monarchs of medieval England, we the people of a sovereign nation would not be dependent on loans from a cartel of private financiers. We would not need to pay income taxes. We might not need to pay taxes at all. So, in the happy ending to our economic fairy tale, the drought of debt to a private banking monopoly is destroyed with the water of a free-flowing public money supply. Among other salubrious results, we the people never have to pay income taxes again. That possibility is not just the fantasy of utopian dreamers, but is the conclusion of some respected modern financial analysts. One is Richard Russell, the investment advisor we have discussed earlier, whose Dow Theory letter has been in publication for nearly 50 years. In his 2005 newsletter, Russell observed that the creation of money is a total mystery to probably 99% of the U.S. population. Then he proceeded to unravel the mystery in a few sentences. Quote, "To simplify, when the U.S. government needs money, it either collects it in taxes or it issues bonds. These bonds are sold to the Fed, and the Fed in turn makes book entry deposits. This debt money, created out of thin air, is then made available to the U.S. government. But if the U.S. government can issue treasury bills, notes, and bonds, it can also issue currency, as it did prior to the formation of the Federal Reserve. If the U.S. issued its own money, that money could cover all its expenses, and the income tax wouldn't be needed. So what's the objection to getting rid of the Fed and letting the U.S. government issue its own currency? Easy, it cuts out the bankers and it eliminates the income tax." Close quote. And I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, in a February 2005 article titled "The Death of Banking and Macro Politics," Hans Schicht reached similar conclusions. He wrote, quote, "If prime ministers and presidents would only be blessed with the most basic knowledge of the perversity of banking, they would not go onto their knees to the central banker and ask His Highness for loans. With a little bit of brains, they would expropriate all banking institutions. Expropriation would bring enough money into the national treasuries for the people not to have to pay taxes for years to come," close quote. Expropriation, however, means to deprive of property, and that is not the American way. At least, it is not in principle. The robber barons routinely deprived their competitors of property, but they did it by following accepted business practices. They purchased the property on the open market in a takeover bid. Their sleight of hand was in the funding used for the purchases. They had their own affiliated banks, which could lend money into existence with accounting entries. If private banks can do it, so can the federal government. Commercial bank ownership is held as stock shares, and the shares are listed on public stock exchanges. The government could regain control of the national money supply simply by buying up some prime bank stock at its fair market price. Buying out the entire banking industry would not be necessary, since the depository and credit needs of consumers could be served by a much smaller banking force than is prowling the capital markets right now. The recycling of funds as loans could be left to private banks and those non-bank financial institutions that are already serving a major portion of the loan market. Although buying out the whole industry would not be necessary, it might be the equitable thing to do, since if the government were to take back the power to create money from the banks, banks' stock could plummet. Indeed, if commercial banks could no longer make loans with accounting entries, the bank's shareholders would probably vote to be bought out if given the choice. Assume for purposes of argument, then, that Congress had decided to reclaim the whole commercial banking industry, as an assortment of populist writers have suggested. What would that cost on the open market? Using 2005 figures, the total book value, assets minus liabilities, of all U.S. commercial banks was reported at $850 billion. Book value is what the shareholder would receive if the banks were liquidated and the shareholders were cashed out for exactly what the banks were worth. In good economic times, shares trade on the stock market at substantially more than this figure, but the price is usually no more than a generous 2x book. Assuming that formula, around $1.7 trillion might be enough to purchase the whole U.S. commercial banking industry. Too much for the government to pay? Not if it were to create the money with the accounting entries the way banks do it now. But wouldn't that be dangerously inflationary? Not if Congress were to wait for a deflationary crisis. Recall the Federal Reserve warning in 2005 that a major correction in housing prices could shrink the money supply by about $2 trillion. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke suggested in 2002 that the government could counteract a major deflationary crisis by simply printing money and buying real assets with it. Buying the banking industry for $1.7 trillion in new greenbacks could be just what the doctor ordered. It is not likely to happen, though, but it is a theoretical alternative. The government could buy out the bank's shareholders, but there is a cheaper way it could pick up the bank branches required to serve the public needs. Enough branches might be picked up by the FDIC for free just by conducting an independent audit of the big derivative banks and putting any found to be insolvent into receivership. Remember Murray Rothbard's contention that the whole commercial banking system is bankrupt, and belongs in receivership. We talked about that before. Banks owe depositors many times the amount of money they have on reserve. They have managed to avoid massive run on the banks by lulling their depositors into a false sense that all is well, using devices such as FDIC deposit insurance and a reserve system that allows banks to borrow money created out of nothing from the Federal Reserve. But that bailout system is provided at taxpayer expense. By rights, said Rothbard, the whole banking system should be put into receivership and the bankers should be jailed as embezzlers. If the taxpayers were to withdraw the taxpayer-funded props holding up a bankrupt banking system, the banks, or at least some of them, could soon collapse of their own weight, and the first to go would probably be the big derivative banks that have been called zombie banks, banks that are already bankrupt and are painted with a veneer of solvency by a team of accountants adept at creative accounting. Insolvent banks are dealt with by the FDIC, which can proceed in one of three ways. It can order a payout, in which the bank is liquidated and ceases to exist. It can arrange for a purchase and assumption, in which another bank buys the failed bank and assumes its liabilities. Or it can take the bridge bank option, in which the FDIC replaces the board of directors and provides the capital to get it running in exchange for an equity stake in the bank. An equity stake means an ownership interest. The bank's stock becomes the property of the government. The bridge bank option was taken in 1984 when Chicago's Continental Illinois became insolvent. Continental Illinois was the nation's seventh largest bank, and its insolvency was the largest bank failure that had ever occurred in the United States. Ed Griffin writes, quote, "Federal Reserve Chairman Volcker told the FDIC that it would be unthinkable to allow the world economy to be ruined by a bank failure of this magnitude. So the FDIC assumed $4.5 billion in bad loans and in return for the bailout took 80% ownership of the bank in the form of stock. In effect, the bank was nationalized. The United States government was now in the banking business." 4 years after the bailout of Continental Illinois, the same play was used in the rescue of Bank Oklahoma, which was a bank holding company. The FDIC pumped $130 million into its main banking unit and took warrants for 55% ownership. By accepting stock in a failing bank in return for bailing it out, the government had devised an ingenious way to nationalize banks without calling it that. Close quote. The FDIC sold its equity interest in Continental Illinois after the bank got back on its feet in 1991, but the bank was effectively nationalized from 1984 to 1991. Griffin decries this result as being antithetical to capitalist notions, but as William Jennings Bryan observed, banking is the government's business by constitutional mandate. The right and the duty to create the national money supply were entrusted to Congress by the founding fathers. If Congress is going to take back the power to create money, it will have to take control of the lending business, since over 97% of the money supply is now created as commercial loans. As Dave Lewis observed, in some sense, the big banks, considered too big to fail, are already nationalized, since their survival depends on a system of taxpayer-funded bailouts. If taxpayer money is keeping the ship from sinking, the taxpayers are entitled to step in and take the helm. Banking institutions supported by taxpayer money can and should be made public institutions operated for the benefit of taxpayers. I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Continental Illinois may not be the largest U.S. bank to have been bailed out from bankruptcy. We've seen evidence that Citibank became insolvent in 1989 and was quietly bailed out with the help of the Federal Reserve, and that JP Morgan Chase followed suit in 2002. These are two of the country's largest banks, and they are the banks that are the most perilously overexposed in the massive derivatives bubble. Recall the 2006 report by the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, finding that 97% of U.S. bank-held derivatives were in the hands of just five banks, and that the first two banks on the list were J.P. Morgan and Citibank. According to Martin Weiss in a November 2006 newsletter, quote, "The biggest derivatives player, J.P. Morgan Chase, is a party to $57 trillion in notional value of derivatives. Its total credit exposure adds up to $660 billion, a stunning 748% of the bank's risk-based capital. In other words, for every dollar of its net worth, J.P. Morgan Chase is risking $7.48 in derivatives. All it would take is for 13.3% of its derivatives to go bad, and J.P. Morgan's capital would be wiped out, gone. Citibank isn't far behind, with $4.24 at risk for every dollar of capital, more than double what it was just a few years ago," close quote. These two banks are prime candidates for receivership, and the FDIC might not even have to wait for a massive derivatives crisis in order to proceed. It might just need to take a close look at the bank's books. J.P. Morgan and Citibank were both defendants in the Enron scandal, in which they were charged with fraudulently cooking their books to make things look rosier than they were. To avoid judgment, they wound up paying $300 million to settle the suits. But while a settlement avoids having to admit liability, evidence in the case clearly showed fraudulent activities. Banks with a record of engaging in such tactics could still be engaging in them. A penetrating look at their books might confirm that their complex derivative schemes were illegal pyramid schemes concealing insolvency, as critics have charged. If the banks are insolvent, they belong in receivership. J.P. Morgan and Citibank have many branches and an extensive credit card system. Recall that J.P. Morgan Chase now issues the most Visas and MasterCards of any bank nationwide, and that it holds the largest share of U.S. credit card balances. If just these two banks were acquired by the government in receivership, they might be sufficient to service the depository, check clearing, and credit card needs of the people. That result would also make a very satisfying ending to our story. J.P. Morgan and Citibank are the money machines of the empires of Morgan and Rockefeller, the robber barons whose henchmen plotted at Jekyll Island to impose their Federal Reserve scheme on the American people. They induced William Jennings Bryan to endorse the Federal Reserve Act by leading him to believe that it provided for a national money supply issued by the government rather than by private banks. It would only be poetic justice for these massive banking conglomerates to become truly national banking institutions serving the public interest at last. Even if the mega banks or some of them are already bankrupt, we might not hear about it without an independent congressional audit. The over-the-counter derivative scheme masking their insolvency is largely hidden from public view. One way to bring it into the light would be for Congress to impose a tax on all financial transactions. This form of tax is called a Tobin tax, after economist James Tobin, who received a Bank of Sweden Prize in economics in 1981. Even a very modest tax of 0.1% would bring derivative trades out into the open, allowing them to be traced and regulated. And because derivative trading is in such high volume, the tax would have the further benefit of generating significant revenue for the government. Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington points out that financial transactions have been successfully implemented in the past and have often raised substantial revenue. Until recently, every industrialized nation imposed taxes on trades in its stock markets, and several still do. Until 1966, the United States placed a tax of 0.1% on shares of stock when they were first issued, and a tax of 0.04% when they were traded. A tax of 0.003% is still imposed on stock trades to finance SEC operations. Baker notes that the vast majority of stock trades and other financial transactions are done by short-term traders who hold assets for less than a year and often for less than a day. Unlike long-term stock investment, these trades are essentially a form of gambling. He writes, when an investor buys a share of stock in a company that she has researched and holds it for 10 years, that is not gambling. But when a day trader buys a stock at 2 p.m. and sells it at 3 p.m., this is gambling. Similarly, the huge bets made by hedge funds on small changes in interest rates or currency prices is a form of gambling. When poor and middle-income people gamble, they usually engage in one of the heavily taxed forms, such as buying lottery tickets or going to the racetrack. But when wealthier people who gamble in the stock market escape taxation. Baker argues that a tax on derivative trades would only be fair, equalizing the rules of the game. Quote, insofar as possible, taxes should be shifted away from productive activity and onto unproductive activity. In recognition of this basic economic principle, the government already taxes most forms of gambling quite heavily. For example, gambling on horse races is taxed at between 3 and 10%. Casino gambling in the states where it is allowed is taxed at rates between 6.25 and 20%. State lotteries are taxed at a rate of close to 40%. Stock market trading is the only form of gambling that largely escapes taxation. This is doubly inefficient. The government has no reason to favor one form of gambling over others, and it is far better economically to tax unproductive activities than productive ones. From an economic standpoint, the nation is certainly no better off if people do their gambling on Wall Street rather than in Atlantic City or Las Vegas. In fact, there are reasons to believe that the nation is better off if people gamble in Las Vegas, since gambling on Wall Street can destabilize the functioning of financial markets. Many economists have argued that speculators cause the price of stocks and other assets to diverge from their fundamental values. Close quote. A tax on short-term trades would impose a significant tax on speculators while leaving long-term investors largely unaffected. According to Baker, a tax of as little as 0.25% imposed on each purchase or sale of a share of stock, along with a comparable tax on the transfer of other assets such as bonds, options, futures, and foreign currency, could easily have netted the Treasury $120 billion in 2000. By December 2007, according to the Bank for International Settlements, derivatives tallied in at $681 trillion. A tax of 0.25% on that sum would have added $1.7 trillion to the government coffers. A derivatives tax might do more than just raise money for the government. It could actually kill the derivatives business, since even a very small tax leveraged over many trades would make them unprofitable. Killing the derivatives business, in turn, could propel some very big banks into bankruptcy, but the flea's loss could be the dog's gain. The handful of banks in which 97% of U.S. bank-held derivatives are concentrated are the same banks that are engaging in vulture capitalism, bear raids through collusive short selling, and a massive derivative scheme that allows them to manipulate markets and destroy businesses. A tax on derivatives could expose these corrupt practices and bring both the schemes and the culpable banks under the public's control. And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.